You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
I'm Mark Feinsand, executive reporter for MLB.com. Welcome to the Executive Access Podcast. When we started this series back in 2017, we welcomed nearly every general manager throughout the game. The interviews began as a featured part of the MLB Newsmakers podcast feed. There was so much interest in the interviews, we ended up launching the Executive Access Podcast on its own feed in the spring of 2018. Over the past few weeks, we've released a series of throwback episodes from that first season in 2017, featuring Nationals general manager Mike Rizzo, Blue Jays president and CEO Mark Shapiro, Yankees GM Brian Cashman, and more. This week, we present my conversation with Sandy Alderson, who is currently a senior advisor for the Oakland Athletics. Alderson has enjoyed a lengthy, impressive career in baseball, most notably guiding the A's to three American League pennants and the 1989 World Series championship. Alderson went on to run both the San Diego Padres and New York Mets, with a stop at the commissioner's office along the way. Alderson, who was the Mets GM at the time of this interview, discussed baseball's analytic revolution, the differences of running teams in large and small markets, and much more. As we wait for baseball to return, I hope you enjoy this 2017 conversation with Sandy Alderson.
What was your first job in baseball, and how did that come about?
First job in baseball was as general counsel of the Oakland A's. Started there in October of 1981. I was an associate attorney at a law firm in San Francisco, and one of the partners and his family purchased the Oakland A's from Charlie Finley. And I had worked closely with that partner and did a lot of the legal work in connection with the purchase of the team. And about a year later, that was in 1980, and about a year later I went over there full time. So I think I was the first full time general counsel in baseball, which shows you how far the game has come.
As an attorney, you probably baseball operations probably did not seem to be something you thought about as a future. How did that?
Well, in those days, the general counsel didn't have a lot to do. the business was a lot less complex than it is today, and so I had the opportunity to travel around, see minor league teams, do various things. But the real opportunity came when Billy Martin, who was our manager at the time and who thought he was our general manager, was let go. And so we hired a new manager, but there was kind of a void there. And so I was given that responsibility without any experience or real knowledge of the game or of the position, but kind of grew from there.
How overwhelming was that?
Didn't feel overwhelming at the time, but because I was working closely with Roy Eisenhardt, who was the president and the partner. So we kind of felt our way through it. But I didn't really feel any great pressure because I figured I could always go back to being a lawyer if it didn't work out. So,
with a background that didn't start in baseball, are there executives from other businesses or other areas that have influenced you in your baseball career through the years?
Well, I didn't have any real business experience before joining the A's. I was a lawyer for 5 years. I'd been in the Marine Corps, so probably my Marine experience was as informative as anything. Although we certainly didn't run the Oakland A's like the United States Marines, but just basic leadership principles and organization and discipline, and it certainly helped to have had a working relationship with Roy for the previous 5 years at the law firm. So I think that these jobs are as much about judgment as about scouting ability or understanding of analytics, because the real key is figuring out a way to put all that together and make a reasonable decision. So even though in those days I didn't have any experience and very little knowledge, I think Roy and Wally Haas, who was there also, had confidence in my judgment, but that was kind of it.
Right. So. During your time in Oakland, you guys were very successful, made it to 3 straight World Series, won in 89. Mm-hmm. How has the job changed most from that time in Oakland to your time here in New York?
Well, the stakes are a lot higher because the money is a lot greater. And, the margin for error can be smaller. A mistake in those days cost you a few hundred thousand. A mistake these days costs you a few million. And those mistakes can add up. This is a business where mistakes can be made. I mean, it's players make it, players don't, players perform, players don't. The outcome is not always within your control. So what we try to do is focus on the day-to-day process and hope that we're increasing the chances of success by being systematic and organized and process-oriented.
Sabermetrics analytics have become obviously a huge mm-hmm. influence in the game over the past 10, 15, 20
mm-hmm.
years.
Yeah.
You were there sort of at the beginning of it,
right,
with Billy, and I know Moneyball, everybody points to that, but you guys were doing it before then. My question was, I guess, how did you first discover some of these analytics, and what gave you the belief that they were so important?
Well, it goes back to my inexperience at the outset of my baseball career. Because I wasn't a scout, I didn't really have a way of evaluating players, a traditional way of evaluating players. I was pretty open to alternatives that were maybe more accessible to me. And that's where analytics came in. Actually, what got me started was listening to a radio piece on National Public Radio by someone who was local in the Bay Area, who had written a book, a small book, called The Sinister First Baseman. His name was Eric Walker. And this was about the time that Bill James was writing as well. So I was intrigued by it. It seemed to be that some of these, the thesis, importance of on-base percentage and things like that, seemed to be borne out mathematically. And also was consistent with my sort of kind of parochial view of baseball, which is, hey, I love home runs anyway.
Who doesn't, right?
Yeah. So I recall the advocate for the 3-run homer was the manager for the Orioles.
Earl Weaver,
and the advocate for small ball was Gene Mock, who played, managed Philadelphia and everything. So anyway, the Weaver approach appealed to me emotionally, or as a fan.
Right.
But it, the analytics seemed to prove out, and that was probably when that started. That was probably 1982, 83.
You've talked about the importance of analytics and the importance of scouting. Do mm-hmm. you think league-wide scouting has become less important to teams than it has in the past, or do you just think maybe it's as important, but analytics have caught up to be?
It's a good question. I mean, you look at the general managers who've been appointed over the last few years, it would seem that analytics has surpassed subjective scouting because those who are in decision-making positions have more of an analytical background. I think at the same time, though, there's a growing recognition that the numbers themselves don't tell the whole story. And by the way, analytics are themselves subjective in many ways, because what analytics really do is collate data and then interpret the data. And when you interpret the data, you inject your own subjective point of view, because you have to weigh things. So all data isn't equal. And so different clubs, the same is true, different clubs have different views of how that data ought to be used. Nothing is ever totally subjective or totally objective. But sometimes we don't admit that to ourselves. So, and the difficult thing is melding the two into something, a coherent approach that incorporates both.
Paul DePodesta worked for you, I believe, in San Diego and New York.
Yeah.
He's been the chief strategy officer for the Cleveland Browns now for the past 14 months. Do you think this could become a trend in the future where executives from one sport move to another? Or do you think he's a unique
case?
No,
I think it could be, because I think that that the analytics are agnostic with respect to sport. Now, that doesn't mean that you can move sort of seamlessly from one to the other and not recognize that there are going to be shortcomings. And the fact that Paul was in baseball for as many years as he was means that he wasn't in football for as many years as he was. But sometimes, as I said, with respect to how I got involved with analytics, being unencumbered by, you know, conventional wisdom and years of experience can actually be a liberating thing and lead to the kinds of breakthroughs that can occur. So I definitely think that this could be, because the common thread is the analysis and a way of approaching decision making. It's not, you know, the uniform or the playing rules. Fundamentally.
MLB StatCast has introduced some new metrics into the baseball world in the past couple of years. Yeah. How do you view those, and do you think the fact that they're so available to fans has changed the way fans look at the game a little bit?
Well, I think their availability has definitely changed the way some fans look at the game. I think it's also changed the way some teams look at the game. And I think the fact that they are available to fans generally, but also to the more analytically minded fans. I mean, it's like for public access software or whatever they call that. You see some very interesting analysis coming out of, publicly available sources. Which gets back to a point that somebody made a few weeks ago in an article that I read, that there's a very short half-life for new ideas, that the competitive balance, that the competitive advantage that one gets from recognizing a new idea is very short. Because all this information is so available in the public domain, there are people out there who are as smart as we are, or smarter, come to the same conclusions based on that availability of information.
Tony La Russa is widely credited for creating the so-called one-inning closer with Eckersley during your tenure in Oakland. Having watched the way teams used their bullpen last October, do you sense any shift in the way managers are going to use their relievers going forward, or do you think that's a specific situation where it's a shortened time period, you have off days built in, and you can really only do something like that in the postseason?
I think it's tougher to do in the regular season. You might see it bleed over into the last few weeks of a season. But I think the importance of what happened in the World Series is that it did cause people to think differently about how relief pitching is used. And so while we might not see a duplication of what happened in the World Series, I think you might see some innovation. And I think you saw some of that in the regular season. I'm thinking about Cleveland using Andrew Miller earlier in the game. So I think that, and those ideas have been around a while, but I think once you have someone successfully employ, you know, a new idea, even if it's a small variation, people will tend to copy it.
You worked for MLB in between GM stints, most recently 2010, when you worked on addressing a lot of the issues in the Dominican regarding age falsification, the use of PEDs. Mm-hmm. Do you believe those issues have become less prevalent there than they were 5 or 10 years ago?
Yes, I do. And I think that that's in large part to the proactivity of Major League Baseball over the last few years. I'm not going back to 2010, but just in my experience here with the Mets, their proactivity with respect to prospects unsigned by major league clubs, doing drug testing earlier at a period when those players are unsigned, doing background checks to confirm identity before those players are signed, I think has eliminated some of those problems and created more of a level playing field for those players in the Dominican or Venezuela who are competing for those contracts and those dollars and those opportunities. So, I do think, you know, no system is ever going to be perfect, but I do think that they've made big, big gains. And by the way, some aspects of the system in Dominican and Venezuela are important to preserve. You know, the whole issue of Buscones and those who train young prospects, they're an important part of the player pipeline. We just have to make sure that that part of the pipeline is is overseen. Because, in fact, I think there are aspects of that system that we need to import back to the United States. With respect, and in the case of travel teams and things of that sort for youth players, where, you know, there's a little more regulation about how players are used and those kinds of things.
Having run teams in Oakland and San Diego, what are the biggest differences between doing so in those markets and in New York?
Well, the similarities between Oakland and New York stop at the fact that they're both two-team markets, but the media coverage, the fan bases are very different. The fan base in New York is large, knowledgeable, and demanding in some ways, but surprisingly patient in our case. For the first few years that I was here. Fan bases in San Diego and Oakland are not as large. There are smaller cadres of really enthusiastic fans. The media requirements are a little bit different. But, you know, they're major league cities, and, putting a good team on the field is ultimately the goal. And so just that fact, creates pressure to try to be competitive. And oddly enough, I probably, my relationship with the media in Oakland was, I think, very good over the time I was there. My relationship with the media in San Diego was not very good. I learned from that, and I think, so I tried to put it into use in New York. So, they're different environments, but similar demands.
In the September 2011 interview with Newsday, you said of your first year as the Mets GM, quote, "In building a team for the long haul, my goal this season was to try to change the perception of where it's headed." Safe to say that's happened, but when do you think that turned?
It's funny. I think that it took some time. First of all, you have to be able to articulate a strategy, and then you have to be able to stick to it. But eventually, that kind of strategy or idea is punctuated by certain events. And as I go back, I think the uh, I I think, like several events, but one of them was probably the trade for Zach Wheeler that we made. We signed David Wright. You know, we made the trade. We traded R.A. Dickey for some play. There are these seminal events that take place that kind of define a strategy or idea. So, I mean, they come up from time to time, but when you connect them together, they create an impression. But I think the key thing for us was, there's no question, for the first 4.5 years that I was here, we were selling an idea, you know, that this is the direction we were taking, this is how we were going to do it. And as I said, I think Mets fans were very patient, but I think they did buy into where we were headed. And part of the process of buying in was the fact that fans today know so much more about farm systems than they did before. And so there was a belief in what was happening over here in the farm system, even though things weren't going particularly well at the major league level. But because fans sort of knowledge of their team is greater today than it was probably 20 or 30 years ago, it allowed the fans to kind of embrace the whole strategy and not ignore what was going on at the major league level, but at least recognize that it was maybe a necessary phase.
For people who haven't had the pleasure of attending the Baseball Writers Dinner the past few years, I can attest that you're a funny guy. Do you need to have a sense of humor to succeed in this kind of job?
I think it helps. I think it takes the edge off of things. I think if you can respond with a little humor, it takes the edge off of the difficulties that, you know, sometimes teams face, individuals face. I think that if you can soften that with some humor. You have to be careful, though, because humor usually, well, it can often be very pointed, and you got to be careful about how pointed your humor becomes. So,
you guided the A's 3 straight pennants. How much more difficult is that to accomplish the way the game is structured today?
Yeah, no, it's, you know, there are more steps involved, and as a result, I think there's a little more randomness in what happens in a one-game playoff and a five-game playoff, and then there are just several more steps. Back in those days, there was a league championship series. There were two divisions, two winners, and then you go to the World Series. So it's a multi-step process now, which makes it, I think, more difficult.
People often talk about whether New York's a Yankees town or a Mets town. Do you care about that, or is that just something for talk radio to talk about? And have you seen the city sway a little more in the last couple of years?
No, I find that important. I mean, I kind of view the Yankee-Mets thing the way I viewed the Giants-A's thing. And, you know, in San Francisco, in the Bay Area, the default team was always going to be the Giants because they were there first, primarily. And, you know, it's San Francisco and not, the East Bay. But as long as the team played well, as long as Oakland played well, and depending on what, you know, the Giants were doing, we could be the predominant team, and we were for quite a few years. But the Giants were always going to be the default team. I kind of view it the same way in New York. We got to play well for a long time to change the default. But that's part of our mission. So, and I do think things have shifted a little bit. But again, you know, how permanent it is, I think it's all a function of, there are core fans on both sides, but, you're talking about overcoming family biases as much as anything. You know, my father was this, my father was that, his grandfather was this, his grandfather was that. And so when I say, you know, a team that's been around for 100 years versus a team that's been around for, you know, 55, it's kind of what happens.
Right. Which was more satisfying for you, getting to your first World Series in 88 with the A's or getting there in 2015?
Yeah, I'd have to say 2015 because I was kind of a neophyte in 88, and it was like, wow. And then all of our young players said, well, but, you know, we lost in 88. We're going to be back here again. I didn't have any reason to think otherwise either. But it's a very hard thing to do. You know, what transpired at the trade deadline, the fact that we were behind and we played so well, and it was an exciting final 2 months of the season. Then it was an exciting series with the Dodgers, and then, I mean, the whole thing was, you know, we kind of came not out of nowhere, but it all came together in ways that it doesn't usually. So it was satisfying, I think, to a lot of people. And again, the fact that it had been 4 or 5 years and we've been working toward this, and at the very end things kind of accelerated in a positive way. So that was very satisfying.
We hope you enjoyed our latest throwback episode of Executive Access. Next week, we'll feature 3 current executives from the NL West, Farhan Zaidi of the Giants, A.J. Preller of the Padres, and Jeff Breidich of the Rockies. And coming up in future weeks, we'll be back with more than a dozen all-new episodes, including sit-downs with Phillies assistant GM Ned Rice, Pirates president Travis Williams, and more. You can search for Executive Access on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, Art19, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. So be sure to subscribe and enjoy these conversations all season long. If you like what you hear, leave us a review while you're at it. We always appreciate those. And be sure to spread the word and tell all the baseball fans in your life about Executive Access. Until next time, I'm Mark Feinsand. Stay safe, everybody.